Welcome back to the Thermo Diet Podcast. I'm your host, Jayden Miller, and I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Tyler Woodward.
How are we doing today, Jayden?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good.
So today, we're going to be doing a Q&A from the Thermo Diet group. So I'm just going to hop on into it. First question is how to regrow tooth enamel.
All right. Well, if you were looking to, so we want to remineralize your teeth, I think the first and foremost step would be to get the minerals you need to mineralize your teeth. So that would be calcium, magnesium, boron, probably zinc, copper. I would include as the last couple of trace minerals. Anything else I'm missing there?
No, that sounds good to me. I would say like, as if you're pretty thermo, you don't really have to worry about anything other than maybe, increasing your calcium intake and your magnesium intake. You know, if you're eating liver and oysters, you know, a couple times a week and stuff like that, you're probably going to have enough zinc and copper to be able to do it. The calcium intake is going to be a huge one. Yeah. And then also supplementing with vitamin K to make sure to get the calcium in the right place.
And I think getting enough magnesium helps, well, to a point, helps you retain enough calcium.
And then over time, just getting your metabolic rate up as high as possible is going to ensure that your teeth are properly healing from the damage that they've undertaken. And also if you've eaten anything that's super starchy, maybe rinsing your mouth out with something afterwards, or like if you're drinking something super acidic, maybe rinsing your mouth out a little bit with something that's not acidic. Like, you know, if you chug a whole bunch of orange juice, just take a small sip of water after that. Or just don't drink as many things that are super acidic.
I also think you could look into hydroxyapatite toothpaste. So hydroxyapatite is this natural enzyme that we produce that actually mineralizes your teeth and your bones. And they actually make bioidentical hydroxyapatite toothpaste now. It's two companies that I use, one called Boca, and there's another one called Risewell. And there might be a third one that's coming out now, but it's pretty good. I have no complaints. And then I like to do oil pulling as well. Just, I think the big thing is like kind of like stressing in the gym, right? Like you want your teeth to be as de-stressed as possible. So just having your oral microbiome be as clean as possible for as long of the day, or for the as most part of the day as you can, is ideal.
Oil pulling also goes into the next one that we have, is like natural teeth whitening. So oil pulling obviously isn't going to directly impact the color of your teeth, but it's going to help improve the microbiome of the mouth, which is going to have a downstream effect of leading to whiter teeth over time. But also remineralizing your teeth so they don't get into that position either is going to be something to do. You know, also not letting coffee just sit on your teeth, making sure to rinse out your mouth after you drink coffee, like literally just take a sip of water, swish it around, and you're good. Not that difficult, just something that you could do to alleviate stuff sitting on your teeth. I think that's the main issue that a lot of people run into. That, and then also just consistently brushing your teeth. I would recommend, if you're having trouble with tooth enamel, get a very soft toothbrush. I wouldn't get something that's super hard.
And also brush softly. I feel like that's kind of not emphasized enough.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. And then I think they're called neem sticks. They're like these all natural kind of like
whitening sticks.
Yeah. That you can chew on. They're more like natural toothbrushes kind of that you can chew on. So maybe getting a pack of those and see how you like them. I personally haven't tried them before, so I can't really speak for how well they work or anything like that. But that's something that I've seen in the realm of the tooth healing sphere.
Have you ever seen like the mouthpiece thing that has like the red light that's like, it's supposed to whiten your teeth? I think it has red and blue, and it's just like, it's like light therapy.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, that would be interesting. I've seen those around, but I'm not really sure how effective they are or whether or not they're extremely expensive.
I think the question of why teeth become yellow in the first place is also really interesting. Like this, I don't know personally. I know staining is part of it, obviously, but like, I feel like some people just have like kind of almost like skin color. Like some people have a proclivity towards whiter teeth. I have proclivity towards a little bit more yellow teeth. I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. Do you know anything about it?
I don't know a whole lot about it. Mostly the stuff that I've seen is directly correlated with the way that your metabolism is. Like if you have a poor metabolism, your teeth are most likely going to degrade at a more rapid rate than if you had a high metabolism and you're in a regenerative state. your teeth are most likely going to regenerate better over time.
That makes sense. Yeah, I think also underrated is the connection between the oral and gut microbiomes. So if you have horrible gut health, you are bound to have poor oral health as well. So like doing the raw carrier today, getting some coconut oil, some, what is the other oil they recommend? Apple cider vinegar they put on, or some olive oil, both have antibacterial effects.
The olive oil, the extra virgin olive oil is pretty good. I also like the white rice vinegar. I like that better than like apple cider vinegar, just regular like distilled white vinegar. I don't know. I just like the taste better. They're both super, they're all super sour, but that one just, I like it better for some reason.
Other unrelated note, my mom sent me text today that white wine vinegar can be used as a fabric softener, a natural fabric softener.
Oh yeah. So it's also, you can also put like half of a couple cups of distilled vinegar into your washing machine, and it'll help break down a lot of the stuff that cakes up from the soap in there, and it'll kind of clean your washer.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Good to know. Life hacks with Thermo Podcast. Next question, I guess.
How to improve blood flow.
First, I always got to start off with the question, why is your blood flow poor? If you can find the answer to that question, obviously going to give you some direction.
I think it's also worth noting the contextual differences between why you're increasing your blood flow. So like there's a difference between the CO2 related vasodilation versus the nitric oxide vasodilation.
Yeah. It's like a stress versus relaxed state, you would say. Yeah. So I guess also, and it's like, are you having issues in the bedroom, or are you just having like a venous veins build up in the, what are they called?
The spider veins?
Spider veins. Yeah. And you just, or you have like diabetic neuropathy where you just have like painful swelling build up. So it's more like a constant thing versus like an acute thing. Generally, both are going to be the same solution though, which is probably going to be increasing your CO2 levels. So a couple ways that you can do that. Well, one easy way is to do bag breathing. So breathe into and out of a bag, paper bag, preferably for a couple minutes. Just the CO2 you breathe out gets concentrated in the bag and builds up, and then you're breathing in less oxygen. Obviously, if you did it for long enough, you would suffocate. So, you know, to do it for like a minute or two.
Baking soda is also going to help increase CO2 production. What else increases CO2 production?
Well, yeah, the salt helps. Salt's also really good for balancing your blood pressure as well, just because it helps to hydrate your body as much as possible. I think in that context, getting enough of the other minerals as well, so potassium in particular, is going to help you keep sodium outside the cell. Magnesium, calcium as well are also important. The baking soda, so the bicarbonate, so baking soda is sodium bicarbonate. The bicarbonate buffers lactate. So if you're producing lactate, you're not producing as much CO2. So anything that you can get that buffers lactate, also like beta-alanine buffers lactate. Glucose, fructose, both increase glucose production. So anything that increases glucose production or carbohydrate oxidation will increase CO2 because it produces the most CO2 relative to oxygen. So that includes sunlight, thyroid, I believe progesterone. But anything you would add that's more dietary?
Well, from a hormonal perspective, I would also just make sure that you're lowering cortisol and adrenaline as much as possible, because both of those are going to be vasoconstrictors. Mm-hmm. Estrogen is also one of those ones that increases vascular permeability. So decreasing estrogen is also going to be beneficial just for the venous system in general. Outside of that, from a dietary perspective, I'm not a huge fan of recommending like an increase in nitrates in the diet, just because like that's going to increase more nitric oxide production, which is not something that you want to do in a relaxed state. A lifting session or, you know, a cardio session or something like that, like nitric oxide production is going to be essential in order for you to be able to have proper vasodilation, to increase the amount of blood flow to the muscles, to get oxygen into the muscles, to remove lactic acid from the muscles, stuff like that. So in a contextual sense, nitric oxide is important whenever you're in those very active states, but in a relaxed state, CO2 production is going to be the most important thing for vasodilation. And so I don't necessarily think that nitric oxide is a quote unquote bad thing. I think that it's just contextual. So like, why is it being produced? In what circumstances is it being produced? And stuff like that.
Yeah. There's also, I always forget the differences, but there's like iNOS, which is like endothelial, or ENOS is endothelial nitric oxide synthase. And then there's iNOS, which is like, I forget where that one is. I think one is supposed to be like a stress response and one is like a natural response. But definitely both contextual. Both can, I mean, they're both good and bad. You definitely need them. And you just don't want to be running on nitric oxide all the time. I also think it's really important to note that if you are sitting for 16 hours a day, you shouldn't expect to have anywhere decent blood flow. I think moving and literally, you know, getting the blood flowing, quote unquote, literally is probably the most effective thing you can do. Besides all of the dietary measures, like those will help, and balancing your blood sugar and getting enough sodium, all the minerals in will help, but they're only going to help so much if you're sitting on your ass 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Walking is going to be essential for good blood flow, whether you're 10 years old or 100 years old. Like, walking is something that anybody can do, you know, give or take special circumstances. And it's probably one of the most impactful things that you can do for your health all the way around, not even just for blood flow, but decreasing stress, improving hormonal balance,
mobility.
Mobility, improving cognitive function.
Balancing blood sugar.
Yeah. Digestion. Walking is just one of the most beneficial things that you could do. So if you're sitting around all day and you're not walking, you definitely should be walking.
Yeah. Get a standing desk or a treadmill desk.
Yeah. What else improves blood flow? I mean, working out in general is going to improve blood flow.
Avoiding PUFAs, probably sticking to primarily saturated fat. I thought something was interesting I've read on recently that, so the cholesterol that gets lodged into your arteries, it only gets lodged into your arteries, or it only sticks, quote unquote, when it's oxidized. So, getting your metabolic rate up in general will help with preventing arterial plaque. You could also look at K2, which is going to help prevent arterial plaque. Vitamin E is going to help lipid peroxidation, which is kind of related, but slightly unrelated. It's also a blood thinner. So, K2 actually helps to, is a coagulator, so helps to kind of, quote unquote, thicken your blood. It's not going to give you a heart attack or anything. That's not medical advice, obviously. So if you have high blood pressure, you may want to go check with a doctor before taking K2. Vitamin E and aspirin both have the opposite effects, both blood thinners. Not necessarily bad, obviously contextual.
Vitamin C is going to be something that's important to get in for blood flow.
I think magnesium, red blood cell magnesium is going to be important. Probably also, carrot. Get rid of endotoxin, limiting that leaky gut as much as possible.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah. Serotonin is another vasoconstrictor. So taking steps to lower your estrogen and serotonin are both going to have beneficial effects on your blood flow as well. Next question. How do you support your thyroid?
I think there's two steps. I think you want to optimize glucose oxidation, as always. And I don't think thyroid just does glucose oxidation and controls kind of the oxidation of all substrates throughout the body. But I think glucose is primarily what gets inhibited. So you have, eating throughout the day, like small snacks or whatever, to keep your blood sugar in a good range. And then also then you have getting an ample intake of B1, 2, 3, which is going to be really important because they're all necessary for glucose oxidation. So if you eat a ton of sugar, you don't have the B vitamins to break the sugar down into ATP and yada, 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 then that sugar is just going to get stored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I could break it down into like principles, it would be like avoid PUFAs at all costs. Avoid as many phytoestrogens as you can in your environment and decrease stress in all forms, both mentally and physically.
Yes. That's a good one. So I think, so eating as easily digestible foods is a really important one. You kind of talked about that. So basically you don't want a lot of fiber. You want like some of the quote unquote good fiber, like carrots and mushrooms and stuff is all fine. You don't want a ton of like the bean fiber, like the lignans, the isothiocyanates that interfere with thyroid function. What are the other ones?
There's also genistein and diadzine, which are the phytoestrogens and things like soy that you want to avoid.
Goitrogens.
Flax seeds are going to be another one. Goitrogens are huge. A lot of people don't really know that much about them. They're going to be in a lot of the more like leaves and stems.
The brassica vegetables typically,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like the cruciferous vegetables. Okay. So pretty much anything that's like above ground that's not a fruit. So leaves and stems is a great way to put that. Things like kale is probably one of the most notorious goitrogenic foods that there is. And then, you have things like broccoli and all of that other nasty stuff.
You have the other side of avoiding the other halogens. So you need iodine in order to make thyroid hormone. All the other ones, which is bromine, chlorine, and fluorine, all function almost against the thyroid. So they interfere with the thyroid's ability to uptake iodine. They compete with iodine and those receptors. So the more fluoride you can clear yourself out of, chlorine and bromine, which is found in a lot of like textiles, like cheap textiles, typically like your car seats, like kind of like the fake plastics, kind of a nightmare to think about. But if you, the better you can do to avoid that stuff, the better your thyroid will be able to function.
Yeah. Getting a micronutrient panel is going to be, you know, something that is very beneficial, just so you can have an idea of where your iodine levels mm-hmm. are, where your tyrosine and taurine levels are.
I think we forgot a big one. Coffee.
Oh yeah. Well, that's going to be contextual too, because sometimes coffee can be stressful for a lot of people. So it depends.
It's a good test though. If you don't tolerate coffee very well, that is a good sign that your thyroid is probably not balanced. So your blood sugar is not very in a good state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or your liver is just not getting the caffeine out on a quick basis. But, I would say the micronutrient panel is a big one. Something that helped me whenever I was in a hypothyroid state that was really beneficial is regulating the blood sugar and then also filtering my water. That was something that I feel like a lot of people overlook. Getting a shower head filter and then filtering the water that I do drink or use to make some of my other drinks was also something that I think was super easy to do and made a much larger impact than I anticipated it to.
Interesting. I'm excited that I got my filter now. Did that water taste good?
Heck yeah. End of story on how to support your thyroid. Go thermo, get a micronutrient panel, and
walk daily.
Yep.
Maybe some sunlight in there.
Or use some red light therapy on the thyroid as well. That's going to be extremely beneficial. The light is going to help with the energy production of the cells in your thyroid. So whether you want to get like a little red light device to put on there, or sit in front of a red light panel, or whenever you go outside and you have sun directly on the thyroid, sunlight directly on the thyroid, that's going to help as well.
I also was reading something from traditional Chinese medicine that they wore scarves intentionally to protect the thyroid from cold. Mm. I thought that was interesting. Don't have any clinical evidence for it, but I think it goes to show that thyroid's pretty important.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense if you're defending it from like an environmental stressor, I guess. If you're doing jiu-jitsu, don't get choked out that much because you're going to damage the thyroid with people cranking on your neck a lot too. So protect your neck. What are your thoughts on cod liver oil? Is it worth taking? Does this count as an unnecessary fatty acid for the human body? I'll let you take this one because I feel like you have two sides of the coin there.
Cod liver oil is interesting. It threw a lot of people for a loop for a while. And I don't know. I mean, it has its pros and cons. So on its pros, it has a very good ratio of vitamin A to vitamin D. So it has like a 10-to-1 ratio of retinol to D in vitamin D3 form. So it's very bioavailable. It is also a relatively rich source of the PUFAs, omega-3 fatty acids, so EPA and DHA. I mean, the repeat stance on omega-3s is to avoid them at all possible costs. And I think that's not necessarily a wrong stance. But I also think that if someone's not going to eat liver, so if you're not, you need vitamin D, which you can get from the sun. If you are genetically able to convert sunlight to cholesterol or cholesterol to vitamin D efficiently, that's a different test that you should get if you want to do that, or you can get your vitamin D levels checked. You can also take a vitamin D supplement. If you're not getting retinol, which you really need to be eating liver for, I would say to get a substantial amount from, it's like 3 ounces of liver is like 40 pounds of carrots. It's like 5 or 6 eggs. It's, couple ounces of milk. There's a lot of retinol, vitamin A, and liver. So if you are not getting enough from your diet, I think cod liver oil can be a supplement that can help you get enough. It does come at the detriment of some PUFAs. It does also have some monounsaturated fat and some saturated fat. So it's not a, you know, it's not a PUFA bomb like a lot of other substances are, like fish oils, which don't have any of the vitamins really. They just have the omega-3s. So my opinion, those are literal toxins.
They definitely are toxins.
They are literally, they are literal toxins. Throw that shit in the trash.
Yeah. Unless you're like trying to suppress your immune system for a specific reason.
Or you just want a slow, painful death. Then just load up on them. I think that sums it up.
Yeah. I would say that, maybe supplement with a little bit of vitamin E at the same time. If you're going to supplement with them to help prevent a lot of the oxidation of those PUFAs. Also, you mentioned that you found a defatted version of cod liver oil as well, didn't you?
I found it in reference in a study. I haven't been able to find it. The question is, when you get into those, like the fat process where you can defat it, it's like, how do you defat the fat without taking the fat soluble vitamins out? Mm-hmm. And then if you do manage to do that, are you oxidizing the vitamins? So I think it's an interesting, you know, it's a really natural source. Could be cool, especially if you can get the PUFAs out. Could be cooler. Is it practical? I don't know. Well, maybe we'll dive in and get a thermo cod liver oil supplement.
Right. Yeah. But if you are able to eat liver, that's definitely should be your first choice. Yes, and then cod liver oil should probably only be used if there's a vitamin A deficiency, I'd say, for the most part.
And maybe vitamin D as well. But yeah, probably not going to get enough vitamin D from that. Also, if you can just eat the cod liver, I think that's probably like better, quote unquote. Is not, I mean, it's not as concentrated, but I mean, just more of like a natural source. It's probably gonna taste fine too. And like, not like regular liver.
And you know, if you don't want to, if you don't like, you know, just searing each side of your liver, some liver pate is also a good option. That's really delicious. It's going to be a little bit more cooked, so it's not going to have as much active vitamin A in there because some of it's going to get denatured during the cooking process, but, it's still going to have a decent amount in there.
I thought liver pate was raw.
It might depend on how you cook it. I know some people that slow cook it for a really long time at a low temperature. So that's what I'm referring to, but there might be a raw version of it.
I've heard the best way to make liver is you put it on a sandwich with pickles. The pickles apparently mask the taste.
I do mix it with my ground beef every once in a while, and that's not too bad.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Mm-hmm. Definitely experiment with different ways. If you find a way that you really like, please share it with us and we'll share it in the group. Thoughts on Ray Pete's new recommendations on 50 grams of protein per day. So I think that this is very contextual. I think that this is going to be dependent on your age, what your goals are, your current activity level, and then also like the protein sources that you're getting as well. So like if you're a young individual that's still growing and has, a lot of cellular proliferation happening in your body, a little bit of extra protein is probably going to be necessary to allow that growth to happen, to provide your body with the protein it needs to be able to build the protein that it needs to expand. If you're resistance training, it's pretty much the same thing. Like you need a sufficient amount of protein in order to allow your muscles to have the building blocks that they need in order to build more muscle.
I think your goal should be to gain as much muscle mass as possible, pretty much naturally, because you're not going to gain like, I mean, unless you're lifting for 10, 15 years and in a bulk for the majority of that, you're not going to gain an absurd amount of muscle. That's going to be to a detrimental point. And the higher amount of muscle mass you'll have, and it will be like it's decreasing, right? So if you're like you have 150 pounds of muscle versus 200, you'll need less. You won't need, it's not 1-to-1. You'll need less protein at 200 grams proportionally. But I think your goal should be to get your body to be able to handle as much protein as possible, because muscle mass is beneficial in a myriad of ways. Like it's a glucose sponge, so it lets you absorb glycogen, store glycogen, helps increase testosterone levels, helps lower blood pressure. I mean, muscle mass increases, obviously, sarcopenia, helps fight against that, helps lifting weights, helps fight against osteoporosis. I've talked about lifting weights a lot of benefits. So I think one of the best things you can do, I mean, if you're living like a Ray Pete life where you don't, I'd imagine, do much other than walk and paint and learn a lot, which he's obviously using a ton of glucose because he's a smart lad. He probably doesn't need that much protein. I think for the average person that's an athlete, definitely needs more than 50 grams protein.
Yeah. And his main goal is just to defend himself against atrophy. It's not necessarily to build muscle or to become more athletic. Mm-hmm. So that is something to take into account. Like, the context matters with these recommendations. Don't necessarily take everything for face value.
Yeah. I also think it's a big, important, very important to say like at 50 grams, even if you are like Ray P, I think you are at a, and for the average person, let's say not Ray P, I'm not going to give Ray P recommendations, but for the average person, you are at a much higher risk of getting some atrophy, some muscle loss, sarcopenia at 50 grams than you are at 100, you know? And while there are some detriments to getting too much protein, I would lean on the sides of higher protein for that reason, I would say.
Yeah, like 0.8 grams per pound of body weight is usually the highest that I'll go. And that's usually like the sweet spot in terms of like a satiety perspective too. Like that's something else that I don't necessarily think that he was paying very much attention to, is like for a large majority of the population, 50 grams of protein is not going to be very satiating for a lot of people. Especially since, you know, you're getting your, a lot of your fat and your protein from meat sources or like eggs and, you know, dairy and stuff like that. And 50 grams is a very like small amount of protein. And so you don't really get to eat that much.
He must just be eating like 2,000 grams or 1,000 calories of carbs every day.
Yeah. He must just be eating like gelatin and milk and then getting the rest of his calories from orange juice, maybe.
That and coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With some maple syrup. He's like Buddy the Elf.
Yeah. That's funny. I mean, hey, I love milk and I love orange juice and I probably drink a lot more than the average person. So I can't knock them for that, but 50 grams of protein is very, very low. I think that especially if you're under the age of 25, your body is still growing. So if you're beyond the age of 25, your protein requirements are less, especially if you're not resistance training and stuff like that. But if you're below the age of 25, like protein requirements are going to be a little bit more important just to make sure that your body has a sufficient amount of raw materials that it needs.
Yeah. And I would still, even if you are older, err on the side of caution for getting too little protein. I think it's going to be much more detrimental than getting too much protein.
Yeah. Especially if you're resistance training. Last question. Favorite supplement to boost energy and the worst supplements you have ever tried?
I really like the B vitamins. I think they're just, well, I think magnesium gives you like a calming boost, but I feel like B1, B2, B3, like a nice B complex really like will get you going for the day, especially when you take it with a meal. Like it just like feels like cylinders are all firing. So I'm a really big fan of the B complexes. A nice good B complex, I think, will make you feel really good. Not necessarily like just give you energy. Like, I mean, obviously coffee is a stimulant. And gets you going. But I think that the B complex is like a nice smooth energy flow, especially with some magnesium.
It depends on what category of supplements that I'm talking about. Like if I'm talking about the vitamins, I do really like the Energen supplement that has the B complex. If I'm talking about fat soluble vitamins, I really like a good vitamin E and vitamin K supplement.
You find that gives you energy though?
No. So I was kind of just going along my favorite supplements. In terms of energy, I would say one of the ones that I've noticed that has helped my recovery would be like a progesterone supplement. Obviously, like, you know, if you're a woman and you're on birth control, err on the side of caution and maybe talk to your doctor before you supplement willy-nilly with progesterone. And if you're a man, it might have some libido effects. So experiment with it and see if it affects your libido at all. But progesterone has been something that I find that helps me sleep better and I wake up, less sore and more recovered the next day. If I use a little bit of it, I don't use it that often. I use it very sparingly, but whenever I do use it, I find that, I'm a little bit more well recovered the next day. I usually just use it if I'm like really banged up from a jiu-jitsu session or something like that. Pregnenolone is also one that, I just ordered some more. I'm going to start, supplementing with it for a little bit again. Whenever I've supplemented with pregnenolone in the past, I've really enjoyed it. It's really given me like, just kind of, like a good, what's the word? Like a good wind behind my back, so to speak, I guess. Like it's just a nice smooth, coast, I guess. Not necessarily like a super big boost in energy, but it kind of just
gives a little push.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Instead of sitting down on the couch and me like really not wanting to get up, it's like, all right, I'll get up.
Yeah. I also think if we're talking about like focus wise, I really like choline and Eucuna. I'm taking those before working out and that's been an interesting stack. I've been enjoying that. I think magnesium is really good for like calm as well.
I do notice that I like to take the magnesium. I'll do like a cocktail. So I'll do like the orange juice and coconut water with some salt. And then I'll take some magnesium before I work out. And the pump is amazing whenever I go to the gym. So I definitely recommend doing that if you haven't yet.
Also, I've been looking at, for whatever reason, I've been hungry going to the, well, I know why I've been hungry, but going to the gym, and if you take a little bit of coconut oil, I think the MCTs really help to like power you through the workout.
I can especially
see that. Especially with some carbs too. So like you were saying, maybe probably not any fat in coconut water, but maybe throw a little coconut oil in there.
Right.
Mix it around. And then the next question was the worst supplements, or do you have anything else to add?
So favorite supplements to boost energy, and then the worst supplements you've ever tried and why?
So I've never really tried anything that was bad. First supplement I ever took was Zoom. No, not Zoom. Octane. Well, dude, I mean, some of those old proteins.
Yeah, I would say like I've never necessarily had off the top of my head like an extremely bad experience with the supplement where I had like a super adverse reaction to it. I would say that I've just wasted a lot of money and time and probably some digestive upset with some supplements, like the protein powders that I used to take, some of the pre-workouts that I used to take, stuff like that, just stuff that didn't work pretty much and was just a waste of money. Jake mentioned in the previous podcast that he did the GNC ZMA. Been there, done that.
What is that?
Zinc, magnesium, and B6. Supposedly it raises testosterone at night and helps you recover better. I think that if you're pretty up to date with the thermal principles, you don't necessarily need to supplement with something like that.
Yeah. I went through some bad proteins. You know, it was really bad. Kino Body's BCAAs.
Oh, that was just nasty. Dude, those were so gross.
And I like convinced myself that I had to, well, yo, actually the worst thing I ever had was our Zoo Broth. I tried it cold. Dude, oh my God, that was the worst thing. And I'm a really picky eater. I used to be at least. And I literally forced it down. And then my mom was like, all right, you want me to just heat it up? It would be way better. And I like, she heated it up. And I was like, oh, this isn't that bad. Mm-hmm. Game changer. Don't do cold.
Yeah, I would say what's worse than that is taking the collagen with water. Like I did that once and I never did it again. It was terrible. Every once in a while, I'll hear somebody like taking the collagen with water and they're like, this tastes like shit. Why is it so bad? And I'm just like, I know what you're tasting right there, brother.
Dude, one time I tried to dry scoop collagen because I was in a rush or something. I didn't want to make it into a smoothie or whatever. And I almost died. Like I just started, I don't know what it is. Like it's pre-workout because it's granulated. You can dry scoop. I never dry scoop anything. I think it's stupid. Half the point of pre-workout is to hydrate.
Dry scoop the collagen?
I dry scoop the collagen. And it was one of the worst things. I mean, I'll never do it again. One of the worst experiences. I was just choking. Don't recommend. Don't recommend.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Other than that, I mean, I've taken the fish oil supplements and had like fish oil burps and stuff like that.
Choline burps.
Super oily skin from that too. Like my skin was super oily whenever I was supplementing with fish oil.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably all the ones that I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah. There's nothing that really comes to mind. It's always experiment. Always try something new. And if it's bad, you know, throw it away. I think that's about it.
Thanks for watching this episode of the Thermo Diet Podcast. And if you have any recommendations or questions, make sure to put them in the Thermo Diet group. We're going to be mining that place for questions and posting for questions a lot more consistently. And yeah, we'll talk to y'all on the next one.
Peace.